I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, congressional ethics watchdogs have looked over the shoulders of some three dozen members of Congress so far this term, but formal investigations have been opened on seven, all of whom are members of the Congressional Black Caucus. We'll ask why in just a few minutes. But first, it is Veterans Day. That is the day set aside to honor military veterans in the U.S. and indeed in many countries around the world. It's celebrated on the anniversary of the signing of the agreement that ended World War I. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the challenges and needs of our most recent veterans with Joe Sestak. He's a former Navy admiral and the highest-ranking veteran elected to Congress. But first, we decided we wanted to hear more about the lives some service members are leading after they leave military service, especially people who've made choices one may not expect. So we called Gavin Bradley. He served in the Marine Corps, where he reached the rank of corporal. From there, he went on to the University of Chicago and studied history and political science. And from there, he started teaching. Now, he is the director of college counseling at Pace Academy. And later, we hope to be joined by David Clements, who was a nuclear reactor operator in the Navy, and he is now a cardiovascular perfusionist. And hopefully he's going to tell us what that is. But first, Gavin Bradley, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, hello, Michelle. Thank you.
Why did you join the service to begin with?
My mother's father had been a Marine in World War II, and didn't have sons. He had two daughters. And so he had always, I was the oldest grandchild, and it had always been part of his conversation with me. My father was a university professor when I was growing up, and that was not sort of part of my father's conversation with me. But what had happened after an initial attempt at college, I decided I wasn't ready for college and was looking for something different to do. Those childhood conversations with my grandfather came up at that point, and I just tried to try something different from what most of my friends were doing at that point.
And at what point did you join the Marines? What was going on at that time?
It was 1986. I had left college and was my friends were in college or not doing much productive, and this was sort of a positive path, and it was very good for me. So it was sort of the end stages of the Cold War, I guess, at that point.
So, did you enjoy your time in the service?
It was very good. It was a fantastic opportunity for me to kind of start off in a fairly controlled environment. Boot camp is incredibly controlled, as you might imagine. but the thing about the military and for me the Marine Corps especially is the degree to which they kind of met out your responsibility, and so as you obtain higher ranks, you gain more responsibility for yourself and for other Marines. Ultimately, the Marine Corps, I think, especially with the empowerment that non-commissioned officers receive, and I was an NCO, it meant that I was, I had Marines under my charge, and I was actually in Panama for the invasion in 1989, and I had a fire team that I was responsible for and was part of a platoon there. And it sort of it helps you grow up in a way and mature in a way that I think is very different from college.
And now you're kind of helping other young people grow up in a way as the director of college counseling at Pace Academy in Atlanta, Georgia. That's a private school. I assume private secondary school.
It is, yes, sir.
Is it co-ed?
Yeah, we're co-ed. We're K through 12. So I've got my own children here in the lower school, and I kind of see students across the spectrum. I also coach football here. I'm the college counselor who dropped out of college, but now it helps people evaluate those options. Occasionally we do have a conversation about the military. My school would be classified as very elite, but and so not a lot of our families sort of come here with that goal in mind. But for some of our students that in my past, that's been a good option for them. And having my perspective, I think, has helped some families, given where I ended up going to college. And then I went to graduate school at Columbia University. It's sort of a very different path than people imagine most people in the military take. But in my experience, a lot of my enlisted Marine friends ended up finding themselves in very different circumstances than what their past might have indicated or what their goals had initially been.
Well, I guess I'm wondering that you're serving in the Marines during the invasion of Panama and then being a college counselor at a private school in Atlanta seem like very different experiences. What I do wonder if your experience in the military serves you or how it informs the work that you do now.
I think, having been with sort of people, with a group of people, and again, a number of my friends ended up going to college that didn't make a career of the military or an enlisted career in the military. I think, I've got an empathy for sort of the different paths that students can take. In my current role, I encourage a lot of our students, not a lot, but some of our students, and often boys, to think about other things to do instead of going directly to college. In the last couple of years, we've had a couple of students not go directly to college. They were admitted to schools, but they chose to take, one young man went to Argentina for first semester, and then the second semester of that year after he graduated was in New Zealand. We've got another kid in England right now. And I think I was able to sort of plant that idea, the notion of a gap year. I had a 4-year gap year, I guess. And that's not necessarily advisable for everyone, but taking some time off before going to college made me certainly much, much better college student. And I think we can have those conversations with families and parents, and I'm an example of how that can work out very, very well, I think.
But do you ever just want to, well, I'm just thinking of a, in my high school, we had a famous football and lacrosse coach who we just assumed was a Marine. And wasn't. And the thing he was famous for was that, you know what, if you don't follow my instructions the first time, we're going to go to plan B. And we were always wondering, what was plan B? And I finally had, years later, I had the opportunity to ask him, what was plan B? He said, I don't know, I didn't have one. I'd figure something out. And here's the funny thing, he wasn't a Marine. It's just that we just assumed that he was. And so I have to wonder whether you ever, either as a coach or as a counselor, do you ever, fall on, you know what they say, Marines have a bias for action. Do you ever draw upon that training and what you're doing now?
Well, certainly as a coach, I often am reminded of my boot camp experience specifically. I had some phenomenal drill instructors, and I personally had a very positive experience at boot camp. It was I'd been an athlete all my life, and I've responded very well to that environment. I don't know what my boot camp instructors would say anymore, but I will step out of myself a little bit sometimes and see the drill instructor coming out. Obviously, we coach very constructively, I hope. But I've got to be careful because it is fairly known on campus that I'm a Marine. I'm also about 6'6" and over 300 pounds, so I'm already pretty intimidating to begin with. And students seem to respond to me without a whole lot of the threat.
I bet.
Origin.
I bet. Now we're going to go to Dave Clements from Rochester, Minnesota. He now works at the Mayo Clinic. He's a former petty officer first class in the Navy, and now he is a cardiovascular perfusionist. And I hope he's going to tell us what that is. Dave, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Cardiovascular perfusionist. I work in the cardiac operating room here at the Mayo Clinic. Cardiovascular perfusionist operates the heart-lung machine. So anybody who needs open-heart surgery where we have to stop the heart so the surgeon can work on the heart or whatever, that's my job. I take over the functions of the lungs and the heart and keep the body alive while the surgeon does his work.
That's pretty important.
I think so.
Yeah, I would think so. Now, how did you go from being a nuclear reactor operator to being a cardiovascular perfusionist, and are the two related?
Probably not related at all. As an engineer in my military, they don't relate. I got out of the military and did some research for the government for a few years doing engineering stuff. Was in the Bay Area, California, and around 2000 when the tech jobs started drying up, I started looking at something else. Had some friends that were in the medicine, paramedics, EMTs, and that sort of thing. Went to school to do that kind of work, and then one thing led to another. Moved back to New York where I was from. EMT led into nursing, and nursing got me involved in this field.
And did, can I ask? I asked Mr. Bradley this, and why did you join the Navy to begin with?
I joined the Navy right out of high school. The program that I joined obviously was very technical. I had a great education, and I was always a techie guy, like the math and the sciences sort of thing. So got into the engineering field. It seemed to be the best education opportunity at the time, and that was back in the mid-'80s. So that's what got me into that.
Now, Gavin Bradley was telling us that his students aren't shocked to find out. In fact, it's kind of known that he was a Marine. Or does your military background ever come up in the work that you do now?
Not so much. There's other people in medicine, obviously, that have military experience, doctors, anesthesiologists, and such, and occasionally it'll come up, but it's not a function that readily translates into what I do now.
And I must say, I'm also intrigued by your background as a nurse, because I think as a nuclear reactor operator, we have a certain image of the kind of precision, cold rational thinking,
sure,
emotional discipline that would go into that work. But as a nurse, we think of, you know, empathy, compassion. Was it hard for you to get in touch with your warmer side when you went into nursing?
Probably. That's one of the things my nursing instructors, you know, had to beat into me. But there's a lot of things you can do in nursing. Obviously, my first job in nursing was in the neonatal intensive care unit, so I got pretty in touch with my warmer side there. But I found my way to the technical fields, working in ICUs and emergency departments and such like that. So the technology thing has always been the draw to me.
Okay. Now, I wanted to ask each of you in the minute that we have left, Gavin Bradley, I'll go to you first. And I want to say, as I should have said at the outset, I want to thank you for your service. I want to thank both of you for your service. How would you like the country to recognize your service at this time? As you know, of course, we're still engaged in two wars overseas. So, Gavin Bradley, how would you like us to acknowledge your service? You said you don't talk about it very much anymore.
It's interesting. I was in the Marine Corps from 1986 to 1990, and that was that period when the movie Platoon came out, and there was a real kind of return to honoring veterans, and that was, I guess, the Vietnam War period had kind of come full circle. There's a lot of healing. I've always felt very supported and recognized. I don't know that most of us don't do it for the recognition. I just had a great 4 years, a very good experience, and it's nice that people will come by and recognize me. And today I'll probably have a few people come through. I've already had one too.
Okay.
This morning. And the Marine Corps birthday was yesterday, and that's actually a bigger day for Marine.
Okay. Well, thank you for your service anyway. Sorry. Whether you want the recognition or not, Dave Clemens, just very briefly.
The military is a great experience for me. I got out in 1995. For me, I didn't have any trouble transitioning into civilian life.
Okay.
The only message I would have, you know, there's a lot.
Okay, I'm so sorry, Dave Cummings. We have to let you go. This is Michelle Martin. You're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. To all of our veterans out there, we thank you. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, when you think of Latin American athletes competing in the U.S., you probably think baseball. But we'll tell you about Venezuela's Gravis Vasquez in just a few minutes. He's a University of Maryland basketball standout. But first, we continue to mark Veterans Day. Pennsylvania Congressman Joe Sestak is not the only veteran currently serving in the House of Representatives, but he is the highest-ranking former service member in Congress. The congressman spent 31 years in the U.S. Navy, where he retired as a two-star admiral. He's a Democrat in his second term, representing the state's 7th district. And now he's trying to bring attention to incarcerated veterans. Congressman Sestak is also a member of the House Armed Services Committee, and he's with us now. Congressman Sestak, are you with us?
I am, Michelle.
First, let me thank you for your service.
Thank you, Michelle. They're the best years of my life.
And I understand that you're spending part of the day visiting prisons and meeting with incarcerated veterans. Why have you chosen to spend part of your Veterans Day this way?
Well, you know, we had a case this past year of a fellow young vet that was being taken care of by the VA. Then he was arrested, and there was no transition for his mental health state and the medical help he was having from the VA over to the prison. He was kind of dropped, not purposely, but through the safety net. So when we looked into it, I found out that 61% of all veterans who are in prison are actually dependent upon a substance, alcohol or drugs. And we actually have about 46% of all our prisoners across America are in prison because of a drug violation. And we have, coming home from Iraq and Pakistan, Afghanistan, about 20% at least of our service members with post-traumatic stress disorder coming home in a savage recession, no jobs. Often the care may not be there or quite adequate for what they need. A lot of stress. They then turn to substance abuse, and to take care of their dependency, crimes are committed. How can I learn from these prisoners today
It's been known for some time that post-traumatic stress is a factor for many veterans. Have we made any advances at all in addressing this question? And are there additional reforms that you feel are necessary to provide better care?
Absolutely. My first 2 years in Congress after I got out of the military 3 years ago, we actually increased the amount of money going to mental health and to traumatic brain injury by almost $9 billion. But I met with the Veterans Administration, mental health doctors in Philadelphia, and what I'm finding out is that we still have this almost a closet disease. Members come home and they're worried if they stay in the military that if they report it, it may hurt their career. Second, when they come home, they're given a self-referral sheet. How do you feel? Suicidal or not? If we had 20% of our vets coming home with kidney disease, we'd be meeting them with kidney disease doctors, but in confidence. But more can be done. For example, overseas, we used to have in Iraq one mental or behavioral health expert for every 350 soldiers. Today, it's one for every 750. So I've had several amendments put in that actually have now gotten accepted to where we have a better preventive screening before they go. Number two, when they we are doing a deep study now, just been authorized for how to better treat them, but no, there's so much more to be done.
Wait, can I just get some clarity on one particular point? You said that the ratio of service members to medical personnel with these particular expertise has actually gotten worse over the years. Why is that?
I don't know yet. Part of this is I think they may have put more here at home as those that were coming home needed more help because they were being outpaced. They were caught a bit by surprise. And here's why. Our soldiers in Iraq go outside the wire into a combat-like situation every day for 15 months. And they come for 12 and back for 15 months. It's unremitting on their mental state. In World War II, we had heroes in the most horrific of battles, but on average during that war, they had 182 days of combat with dwell time in between, so their physical nerves came and rested, which helped their mental state a lot. This is a different war. We're actually having prescriptions given to our troops overseas for antidepressants, etc. So when they come home, there's almost an unconscious dependency upon it. No, more needs to be done. And if this tragedy in Fort Hood highlighted anything, it's the tragedy that we've forgotten our military families that are under such stress. We used to have in the Navy the most wonderful of slogans on the commissary bags. Navy spouse, hardest job in the Navy. Only 1/3 of 1% of all American families are directly involved with their loved ones in the war in Iraq or Afghanistan the last 7 years. This is not just our service members. It's our families, our military families, that we have to think about and the stress on them.
Joe Sestak is a member of Congress. He represents Pennsylvania's 7th District. He is a Democrat. He's also a member of the House Committee on Armed Services. We should mention that he is a candidate for the United States Senate, and he joined us on the phone from Philadelphia. Congressman Sestak, let me thank you again for your service, and thank you for joining us on this Veterans Day.
Happy Veterans Day.
Now we turn to Capitol Hill, where 7 House members are currently under formal investigation for alleged ethics violations. Now, Congress is no stranger to ethics inquiries. Some 36 lawmakers are currently under scrutiny by the House Ethics Committee or the Office of Congressional Ethics. But there is one thing that all of the formal investigations has in common, a thread that is raising concern about just how and why investigations are launched. All of the 7 House members under formal investigation are African American, members of the Congressional Black Caucus. We wanted to know more about this, so we called Politico's John Bresnahan. He's been covering the current investigations and has reported extensively on House ethics procedures for years. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, if you'd set the stage for us, last month the Health Ethics Committee opened 2 formal investigations of California Democratic Representatives Maxine Waters and Laura Richardson. The committee was already investigating 5 other members. Is there any through line to these investigations? Are they connected in any way?
Well, 5 of the members are part of 1 formal investigation. It's looking into trips they took to the Caribbean in 2007, 2008, paid for by an organization called Crib News Foundation, and there is an allegation that the trips were improperly paid for using corporate funds. This is one of the reforms that they Congress instituted after the Jack Abramoff scandal, saying earlier you can't use corporate funds to pay for travel. They can be paid for by nonprofits, but it can't just be a facade. It has to actually be paid for by the nonprofit. So during these trips, there were signs that the corporations were – they were actually literally like greeting signs like welcome to the Caribbean from Exxon. So they're looking into whether the members knew or should have known the trips were paid for. Now, they're cleared by the ethics committee, but there was enough there that they could have seen it.
What's the difference between an informal investigation or inquiry and a formal investigation? As I mentioned earlier, the Washington Post reported information that apparently was not meant to be made public, that there were some three dozen members who were being, you know, looked at, as it were. So the first thing I wanted to ask is, what's the difference between an informal inquiry and a formal investigation? And why aren't those things public?
Well, the Ethics Committee, by tradition, is very secretive. It's a 10-member panel. What goes on, it's five Republicans, five Democrats. It's the only bipartisan, fully bipartisan committee in the House. Now, the chairman and ranking member of the committee, in this case, this chairwoman Zoe Lofgren and ranking members Joe Bonner, they can begin an investigation, a review on their own authority. They can even issue subpoenas. But in order to get to an actual place where they can sanction a member or punish a member, they have to do an investigative subcommittee. To do that, the committee votes. All 10 members vote. They form a four-member investigative subcommittee, and that investigative subcommittee does its own investigation, issues a report that goes to the full committee, then votes on it. So at that point, once an investigative subcommittee starts, we know they publicly declare that they are investigating member X for Y. And before that, they can begin a review on their own, and it can be completely secret. Now, there have been some reforms. In 2008, the Congress approved something called the Office of Congressional Ethics, which was supposed to, again, this is a reaction to the Abramoff scandal, this was supposed to make the process more open. The threshold for beginning a review was lower for the Office of Congressional Ethics. So there's kind of a two-stage process. But a formal investigation, we have investigative subcommittees, and you have to have a sanction or some kind of report at the end. That is, at this point, there are only seven African-American lawmakers under review. Now, there are other white lawmakers being looked at by the Justice Department and OCE, the Office of Congressional Ethics, for different things, but the only ones formally under review are black.
And why is that? And I should mention that we reached out to the Congressional Black Caucus through the current chairman, Barbara Lee, who's also of California, to see if the caucus as a group wanted to make some comment about this. They did not respond to our inquiry. So what are people saying about this? Do they feel that there's some racial through line? Is there some sense that African-American lawmakers are under some special scrutiny? Or is there some other reason why? Is it a coincidence?
I think it's partly coincidence, but I think there is – and I don't know fully the answer. I've covered ethics a long time. I've been on the Hill for 15 years. I've never seen kind of a situation like this develop. I don't believe for a second the Ethics Committee is racially biased. I mean, the chairwoman, Zoe Lofgren, is a progressive from California, and I just don't see that at all. But I do think – that the media possibly and maybe some of the watchdog groups are more willing to look at or entertain the idea of investigating African-American lawmakers at the front end. I think it's more on the media. Of the seven members of investigation, five are involved in one investigation. And then there's, of course, Charlie Rangel, the Ways and Means Committee, who's under two separate investigations. So, I do think it's worth looking at.
That was John Bresnahan, Capitol Bureau Chief of Politico. He was here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio. And now we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, which we do just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. Today, another story about how the world is getting smaller, especially the world of sports. In the NBA, for example, even a casual observer of the game can tell you that the game has become more global. On any given night, you can spot superstars like China's Yao Ming, Germany's Dirk Nowitzki, and Spain's Paul Gasol. But one country that hasn't made much of an impact is Venezuela. The country has given us any number of professional baseball and soccer players, but only more recently has basketball become a national passion in Venezuela, and the player at the center of attention is Gravis Vasquez. He's a point guard for the University of Maryland, and Washington Post reporter Steve Yonda joins us now with the story. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How did you get interested in this?
My beat with the Post is to cover the Maryland men's basketball team, and so doing that last season, I got to know Gravis a little bit, and just at one point just asked him, if I could get out there, would you show me around? And he was open to it.
Which is interesting, because one of the things that the story suggests is that he's not just important to the University of Maryland. It's almost like he's got the whole country on his shoulders as sort of opening up the whole sport for his country. There's a lot of responsibility for a young guy.
Certainly, and I think he's reopening the sport to them because mm-hmm. they've had very few isolated cases where players have made it to the NBA. But
not for long.
Not for very long.
They've not been high-impact players.
Not at all.
Not like a Yao Ming who's a huge star.
Right. They had one player who was on a championship team, but people down there think and they hope, and I had one guy who prayed in front of me that Gravis can be the guy who can last and who can show future generations of basketball players that they not only can make it to the NBA, but that they can last there and that that can be a possibility for them.
Tell me about the community where he grew up.
His father lived near a racetrack, and Gravis is a huge horse racing fan. And both his mom and his dad, they lived in what are called barrios. But Gravis, by no means, his family was not, you know, the poorest of the poor. This is not a rags-to-riches story. His dad lived, like I said, in one barrio, El Coche, near a racetrack. And his mom lived in a separate barrio across town.
They're not together.
No, they're not. And you look out their windows and you look toward the outer part of the city and you can see it gets poorer and poorer as you look up.
What are his strengths as a player?
There is a term that is thrown around in sports, someone who is called a gamer, who just, for whatever reason, when the lights come on and the pressure's on, you know, they perform well. And Gravis is a gamer. You know, he shows up when his team needs him to. And that can be in terms of points. That can be in terms of rebounds. That can be in terms of assists. He led his team in all three categories last year.
I would assume, like many college basketball players, he hopes to make it in the pros.
He talks about it constantly. It is clearly a goal for him. And whether he can make it, I think this past summer was a good litmus test for him. He entered the NBA draft and tested out in front of team after team, and he ended up pulling out. No team would guarantee him that they would take him in the first round. Even teams early in the second round were cautious about, you know, giving him a guarantee. You know, if you stay in, we'll take you here. And there were several reasons for that. He's not consistent with his shot. And in terms of speed and agility on defense, being able to keep up with quicker guards, if he can address those issues, if he can, you know, develop a consistent shot and you know, kind of go through the checklist of the things that he was told he needed to work on, yeah, he can last. He certainly has the drive to do it, that's for sure.
I want to go back to something we talked about earlier, which is the place he grew up in Venezuela. One of the points that you make in the piece is that he's not living in sort of desperate poverty in a tin roof shack and with no running water. But he is surrounded in a context where there's a lot of pressure to get involved in other activities, like drug dealing, for example. I mean, there's this very vivid scene where I assume they're drug dealers. He's kind of watching a pickup street game, and these guys are out there recruiting all the time. They don't particularly care that you can play basketball. And I'm just interested to know whether that was actually a possible path for him. And did he have to work, or did he and his parents have to work to keep him off of that track?
Certainly it is an option for every kid growing up in Caracas. One of the basketball coaches told me, you know, when you're a boy growing up in Caracas, you have two paths. You can go with the drug dealers or you can go with sports. And with Gravis, it was no different. There was certainly pressure on him from drug dealers called malandros in Venezuela, and they approached him. And his father was a positive influence in keeping Gravis away from that kind of thing.
So if he is feeling sort of the pressure of being the national hope of Venezuela, it doesn't seem to be harming his game.
Well, and that's a distinction I would draw, too. He is aware of it. I don't know that he views it or it affects him as pressure. He doesn't carry it with him like maybe other people would.
Washington Post reporter Steve Yanda wrote the cover piece for the Washington Post magazine, Loud and Proud, profiling Gravis Vasquez. He's a point guard for the University of Maryland. And if you want to read the piece in its entirety, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, and then go to Tell Me More. Steve Yanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Red Bull, Monster, Rockstar energy drinks are the go-to beverage for clubgoers and college students and the occasional journalist facing a deadline. But now an anti-energy drink is being marketed to urban youths that promises a mellow time. But some critics are sounding the alarm about a new drink called Drank. We'll tell you why in just a few minutes. But first, a different kind of beverage, one that most school kids are happy to see in the lunch line, but that is leaving some parents and nutritionists cold, namely chocolate milk. Some school systems are considering taking chocolate milk off the menu at the urging of nutritionists who say children just do not need the extra calories and sugar, and they will drink plain milk if it is offered. But now the milk industry has struck back. This week, the Milk Processor Education Program and the National Dairy Council have launched a new campaign titled Raise Your Hand for Chocolate Milk. They've enlisted celebrity moms like Rebecca Romaine, as well as a group of their own nutrition experts, to press the case that chocolate milk is just as healthy as plain white milk.
I like chocolate milk, and I know my girls will too. It's a great way for them to get all the nutrients that go with it. That's why I'm raising my hand for chocolate milk.
That was, of course, Rebecca Romaine. Joining us now to talk more about this are Keith Ayoub. He's a pediatric nutritionist at the Albert Einstein Medical Center. He has been a consultant to the milk industry. And also with us, Marlene Schwartz, deputy director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. I welcome you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm not going to ask you all what you had for breakfast this morning, whether it was chocolate milk or plain milk. But Marlene, I'm going to start with you and ask, why do you want chocolate milk tossed off the school lunch menu?
Well, I think what's important to realize here is that milk absolutely is an important part of children's diets, and I am certainly not anti-milk. But we know from research that we've done and others that children will drink plain milk. And the WIC program, which is the Women, Infant, and Children program in the United States, does not support the use of chocolate milk. Head Start centers, preschool centers around the country all serve plain white milk. And what we've observed is that the children will drink it. So the question is, if children will drink regular milk when they're 3 and 4 and 5 years old, why is it that when they enter kindergarten, suddenly we think, oh, no, they're not going to like it anymore, and we introduce something that's significantly higher in sugar and calories.
Mr. Ayoub, before I ask your perspective on this, we mentioned that you have been a consultant to the milk industry. Can I ask, were you a paid consultant, and how recently?
Yes, I was, and it was last year. And I would also, I was actually asked to give them, along with some others, just sort of what I would call scientific counsel, because of what I do in my normal day life. I'm an associate professor of pediatrics, but I also am a clinician. And after I hang up, I'm going to see patients all day. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very, very attuned to the issue of childhood obesity. I have been sort of fighting it on a long-term basis for the last 25 years here. So I fully understand the issue of extra calories and things like that. What I don't really understand, however, is that there's a lot of evidence that shows that kids who drink and we're talking about low-fat chocolate milk or fat-free chocolate milk, okay? We're not talking about anything else here. Mm-hmm. Is that when kids have the choice, they will often choose chocolate milk, but they'll also drink more milk. They'll not only drink more in the way of, you know, they'll choose chocolate milk, but kids who drink chocolate milk also drink more white milk. And we know that about 7 out of 10 kids have diets that are deficient in calcium. And I guess what I also noticed and what's happened in New York City is when a district here in the Bronx pulled chocolate milk off the menu, they found that there was a reduction in milk consumption by 10%. And that's concerning, because if you extrapolate that over the course of over the whole of New York City, which has 1.1 million kids, that would be 110,000 kids who aren't going to drink milk. And I'll tell you, we need to think of this not just in terms of what goes on in the school day, but I think of it in what happens after the school day is over. Because what I see is when they come and sit in the waiting room here, is that when kids don't drink milk at lunch, not only are they not likely to get enough calcium for the day, but they're also not going to get 8 ounces of fluid. They're not going to get 8 grams of protein, and they're going to end up the school day more hungry and more thirsty.
So you're weighing the balance. You're saying on balance, it's still worth it to keep chocolate milk on the menu.
And not only my words, though, but this is specifically outlined in the dietary guidelines.
Okay, hold on a second. I'm going to let Marlene respond, but I'm going to ask Vivian Godfrey, who's CEO of the Milk Processor Education Group, told us that most kids choose chocolate milk over plain milk, and she says that in the absence of chocolate milk, they'll choose to drink juice, soda, or water rather than plain milk. So, Marlene, you've also done studies on children and their food choices. What about that?
Well, what we found in our research is essentially children drink what's served. And so, sure, if you put chocolate milk next to plain milk, a lot of children will choose the chocolate milk. Of course they will, because it's higher in sugar and it tastes sweeter. I think the key is to really promote the drinks that you want them to be consuming. In this case, it would be plain milk. And in terms of the research, when I've looked into the research on this, what I found in articles published in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association last year that looked at national data is that when you're looking at small children, mentioned, the vast majority of them actually are exclusive plain milk drinkers. So I don't think we're talking about the majority of children overall. And I think what this campaign is really about, it's about the sale of chocolate milk in schools. And I think what's motivating it is not a lack of calcium in children's diets, but rather the fact that 58% of the chocolate milk sold in this country is sold in schools. And I think they're worried about losing that part of the market.
Well, sure, but sure, that sounds plausible. But the fact is, what about what Mr. Ayoub said, that a lot of the kids who are getting their best nutrition at school, they're not going to get the other stuff at home. What about that? Don't find that
well,
possible?
I think we've painted ourselves into a corner.
Let Marlene respond, and then Mr. Ayoub, I'll come back to you. Briefly.
My point is that I think we've painted ourselves into a corner. It's just like with the soft drinks in the schools or with high sugar cereals in the schools, that they're already used to these extremely sweet beverages and these, you know, sweet cereals. And so, of course, when you take them away, there's going to be an adjustment period. So I'm not surprised that, you know, consumption might have gone down slightly when they were taken out of the schools. But it's almost like we need to retrain children. We've, okay. you know, sort of fallen into this trap of just adding sugar to everything, to their cereal, to their milk.
Sure.
And then we're surprised when they have a preference for high sugar foods.
All right. Well, I gave you the first word. I'm going to give Mr. Ayoub the last word. Mr. Ayoub, what about that? I mean, why not just offer the best choices and teach kids to choose that?
And that's sort of a root canal approach, but I have to say that the amount of sugar that's in chocolate milk, or that amount of sugar that kids get from chocolate milk, accounts to about 2 or 3% of the sugar that they get. And if we left out the more junky drinks that kids drink, that would pretty much remove the vast majority of sugar. Now, the dietary guidelines specifically cited flavored milk as a way to use some extra added, what they call discretionary calories, to drive the consumption of more nutrient-rich foods, like milk. So it's a good way to spend those extra calories that we all know kids are going to have it, on
it,
some
it's
level.
An interesting discussion, and we thank you both so much for your work in this area and for talking to us about it. Keith Ayoub is a pediatric nutritionist for the Albert Einstein Medical Center. As he mentioned, he has previously been a paid consultant to the milk industry, and he was kind enough to join us by phone from his office in New York. Marlene Schwartz is the deputy director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University, and she was kind enough to join us from the studios at Yale University. I thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Some health officials, as we just discussed, may be trying to get chocolate milk out of the schools, but is it really any worse than what kids can buy at the local 7-Eleven? Now at many local convenience stores, alongside popular drinks like Red Bull, Monster, and Rockstar, you may see another product that touts the exact opposite effects of these energy-boosting concoctions. It's called Drank, and it claims to be, quote, the first extreme relaxation beverage. Now, critics of Drank worry that it isn't just another beverage. First of all, they're concerned about the origins of the product. The term purple drank is slang for an illegal brew of codeine syrup and alcohol that is popular among some influential tastemakers in the South's hip-hop scene. Joining us to talk more about this is Ronald J. Peters. He's an associate professor at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston, and he is an expert in codeine abuse. He also specializes in cultural and economic aspects of health behaviors in underserved communities. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Professor Peters, how did you hear about Drank?
Well, one of the things with my research I try to do is actually just listen to music. And when you listen to music, you find out what kids are interested in. So listening to a very innovative form of hip-hop music called screw music that was started here by DJ Screw, found that a lot of kids in the South had high social approval for codeine promethazine abuse. So we started doing research on the social norms of this particular and the beliefs of kids around this particular substance.
And why do they like it? What does it do for them?
Well, it's three things. You have three different basic substances in codeine promethazine. You have alcohol. You have antihistamine, which all of us have obviously taken before. It makes us drowsy. And then you have the actual codeine in it. Because of the hip-hop music being so popular, this particular trend diffused throughout literally the United States, and it has high social approval, even in other parts of, when you get on the Internet, at least on blogs all over the world.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to a little piece of the kind of music Professor Peters is talking about. This is Project Pat singing That Drank.
Sipping on some purple, I'ma call it purple. Leaning to the seaside, cool like a purple. We got me purple, eyes tight like turtle. Cruising through the hood slow, something like a turtle.
Okay, so I think you get the point. But it's important to make one distinction. They're singing about purple drank, which is an illegal substance mixing codeine and alcohol. And now what we want to talk about is a legal product. Important to emphasize, this is a legal product called drank. And I do want to mention that we extended an invitation to Peter Bianchi. He's the founder and CEO of Innovative Beverage Group, which is a Houston-based drink distributor and maker of drank. He declined our request to join our conversation. He sent a statement, which I'll read to you in just a few minutes. But drank contains ingredients like valerian root, rose hips, and melatonin, and it invites users to, quote, slow your roll after a hectic day. Do you have any concerns about this product?
Absolutely. You know, this is the worst thing I've seen on the market since candy cigarettes. In fact, it's worse. Both codeine promethazine and this particular valerian root and melatonin, you have issues of insomnia, sleepiness, and issues of kids in particular not being alert. Now, again, it doesn't have the same euphoric effect as codeine or alcohol, but they have dosages of this particular concoction that could lead to kids having, obviously, daytime drowsiness in school, operating motor vehicles. The same thing with codeine promethazine. We're more concerned about the kids when they get in cars after parties and so forth. And when you have this substance, it's doing some of the same issues, making kids sleepy.
Let me just read the statement from the from Peter Bianchi, who's the CEO and founder of the company that's making and distributing this product. And we'll have the statement on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on programs, go to Tell Me More, and we'll put his statement up in its entirety. But I'll just read you the first paragraph. He says, "We live in a high-paced world, and that, coupled with the current economic conditions that we are in, has created a society that is incredibly high-strung and stressed out. This is made worse by the way that we have all been spoon-fed energy drinks for years to help speed us up. I saw all of this and realized that there was a need in the marketplace for something that will help us relax, de-stress, and as we like to say, slow our roll." He's trademarked that phrase. "So using calming ingredients of melatonin, valerian root, and rose hips mixed with great grape flavor and light fizz, I created drank," he's trademarked that, "the first extreme relaxation beverage." And so it sounds to me like what he's saying is this is for adults who are stressed out. You don't buy that. You don't think
sure,
that's who's going to buy
for
that.
Professionals and so forth that he states on the website. But, you know, how come he'd call it drink? That's what kids call codeine promethazine. How come it's purple? How come it's actually giving some of the same effects as codeine promethazine? This is not something I think that's targeted towards adults, but the hip hop culture is being prostituted, in my opinion. They trademark some of these different slang words that are common terms in the streets and then use it for profit.
Well, what would be the appeal of it? I mean, I understand that Red Bull has become very mainstream for, you know, you see students drinking it who have term papers to finish. You know, it is not uncommon around here for people who particularly have to work odd shifts when we'll see a can of Red Bull from time to time. So who would want this other anti, what is it, whatever they're saying, extreme relaxation concoction? Why would you want that? In fact, and then in the hip-hop literature songs that you have monitored, how is it promoted? What's the appeal?
Well, appeal is, again, is something that people are proud of. Houston music, this was something that put Houston on the map, so there's a lot of high social approval for it. You don't look crazy when you're drinking codeine promethazine. You looked at it as being, as they call it, a player potion, so to say, being cool. And see, the issue with this is there's a lot of kids that don't know better. These are gateway kids. For the kids that are drinking this, they look at this as being silly, that are drinking codeine promethazine. But for the kids that don't know what purple stuff is, that have heard it in their songs, that have heard it in their communities, they pick this stuff up. If you look on blogs on the internet, they're question after question, what is purple stuff? You know, how do you make purple stuff? And so, again, they would go ahead, take this particular substance and drink it, and it could be a gateway to the real thing. Everybody wants the real thing. When they find out that they have been, so to say, bamboozled, then they'll quest, some of us will quest to get the right thing. I was talking to a parent the other day, and their kid picked this up out of one of the convenience stores. And she said, "What is that?" He replied, "Grape soda. It's just grape soda." And then when she found that this was actually drugs that were put in this, that were literally sleeping agents, she was just so disappointed in herself that she didn't do the research before our kids started drinking this every day, literally. So I'm concerned about the parents who don't have knowledge of this. I'm concerned about the kids that have access to this in their communities, and they're taking this to have a cool image, and it affects them long term.
And it's certainly available. 7-Eleven has informed us that it is available in approximately 1,500 of their 5,800 stores in the U.S. are carrying the item. They say it is a recommended item, but the majority of their stores are operated by franchisees, and they can choose to carry it or not. They say the item is selling well, with the highest sales in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So, Professor Peters, you've made it clear you're not pleased. What do you think people should do now if they have, if they share your concerns?
The major thing I wanted to state is that, see, we spend a lot of time getting this codeine promethazine as far as with getting it off the streets and making it less accessible to kids over the last 10 years. The prices went up from a bottle, it went up from $120 to $325 a bottle. And I'm concerned now that all of the work that we've done, you know, they could prostitute, again, all of the hip-hop music to go ahead and create something else that's bad for kids. And so I think we should gather. If you do have concerns, in particular in Texas or in the southern states, we need to go ahead and rally and have some socio-political action where we can get this stuff out of the stores.
Ronald Peters is an associate professor of public health at the University of Texas Health Science Center. He was kind enough to join us from the studios of KUHF in Houston, Texas. And I want to emphasize once again that we did reach out to Peter Bianchi, the founder and the CEO of Innovative Beverage Group, which makes and distributes drank, and he declined to join us. We'll have a statement from him on our website if you care to read it. Professor Peters, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.